This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, it's Rachel Wright from the Global News podcast. We're bringing you the latest from Syria, where the Defence Ministry says it's ended military operations in strongholds of former President Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you from our studio in central London, I'm Celia Hatton. For years in Canada, it was accepted that Mark Carney didn't want to wade into politics. He turned down approaches from both the major Conservative and Liberal parties, preferring instead to remain an enthusiastic economist. Now, without ever winning an election, he's about to become Canada's Prime Minister, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Canada is facing a spiralling trade war with the United States, its biggest trading partner by far. It's a move that could cripple the Canadian economy. Anxieties in Canada are already running high. Mr. Trump's repeatedly threatened or joked about turning Canada into America's 51st state. That's left Canadians feeling defiant but also vulnerable. Canada has about one-tenth of the U.S. population, and the two share the world's longest undefended border. So Mark Carney echoed some of the rising fear and frustration Canadians are feeling as he took the helm of his Liberal Party on Sunday evening. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
So Donald Trump thinks he can weaken us with his plan to divide and conquer. Pierre Poilievre's plan will leave us divided and ready to be conquered. Because a person who worships at the altar of Donald Trump will kneel before him, not stand up to him. The Americans want our resources, our water, our land, our country. Think about it. If they succeeded, they would destroy our way of life. And Canada never, ever will be part of America in any way, shape, or form. The Canadian government has rightly retaliated and is rightly retaliating with our own tariffs that will have maximum impact in the United States and minimum impact here in Canada. My government will keep our tariffs on until the Americans show us respect. We didn't ask for this fight, but Canadians are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. So the Americans, they should make no mistake, in trade as in hockey, Canada will win.
Well, I should say that dropping the gloves is a reference to what happens before a fistfight takes place on the ice in ice hockey. And meanwhile, the trade war drags on. Ontario, Canada's most populous province, announced a 25% surcharge on electricity exports to the U.S. today. Here's Ontario's Premier, Doug Ford.
We will apply maximum pressure to maximize our leverage. That's why today we're moving forward with a 25% surcharge on electricity exports. For the 1.5 million American homes and businesses that Ontario powers, homes and businesses in Minnesota, Michigan, and New York. This surcharge will cost families and businesses in these states up to $400,000 each and every single day. On an average, this will add around $100 per month to the bills of hardworking Americans. Let me be clear, I will not hesitate to increase this charge. If necessary, if the United States escalates, I will not hesitate to shut the electricity off completely.
That was Doug Ford speaking in Toronto today. Well, let's speak to someone from Mark Carney's party. Yasir Naqvi is a Liberal Member of Parliament for the scene known as Ottawa Centre. Thank you for joining us. Can you take us into the Canadian mindset for a moment? Mark Carney says that supporters of Donald Trump, if they succeeded, would destroy our way of life. Those are the big words. Does Donald Trump really want to destroy the Canadian way of life?
Well, this is a big moment for our country. As you laid out, we have a really strong relationship with the United States. We've been friends and allies for a very long time. We share the continent together. We have one of the largest borders, undefended borders in the world. And we had never imagined as a country that we will be engaged in a trade war with our closest friend and ally, where the president of the United States will be openly speaking about annexing Canada. So what you heard from Mr. Carney in his acceptance speech, what you're hearing from Premier Ford, is really rising up to that moment and making sure that we do everything in our power to protect the economic interests of all Canadians, but most importantly, to also protect our political sovereignty.
But Canada's economy is also very small in comparison to the U.S. economy. What can Canada realistically do about any of this? Can you really win a trade war, as Mr. Carney says?
Canada has a very strong economy. Canada is a member of the G7. So it's one of the strongest economies around the world. We have abundance of natural resources that we export to United States and other parts of the world, not to mention a very strong manufacturing sector as well. And of course, we continue to grow in information technology also, and again, work very closely with Americans on that. So Canada is from an economic perspective, is a strong country, is a growing country. We are over 40 million people, and more people wants to come to our country, and we will continue to build our economy even further. But if somebody is going to threaten our economy, even if that is our closest friend and ally, who's not acting like one, of course, we're going to do everything in our capacity to defend ourselves.
Mr. Nakvi, you paint a rosy picture, but your party really wasn't doing very well in the polls before Mr. Trump came into office. Just to take a look at your next leader, too, Mr. Carney was largely educated outside Canada. He spent a lot of his career outside of his borders. He's been accused of being an elitist, one who's educated at Oxford and Harvard. He also isn't fluent in French, one of the country's official languages. Now, in regular times, these would be huge political liabilities against him. Why would voters overlook these things now?
Well, Canadians are looking for a strong leader. Canadians are looking for a leader with experience who have dealt with crises in the past. And that's exactly what Mr. Carney is offering, especially when you compare him to other political leaders in the opposition parties who have been lifelong politicians and don't have the kind of experience necessary at this moment to defend the interests of Canadians. Mr. Carney has served as the governor of Bank of Canada. He was instrumental in during the 2008 financial crisis to help steer Canadian economy. Later on, he was the governor of Bank of England and was instrumental in helping United Kingdom through Brexit. All those experiences are quite relevant at the moment. And the reason why you have seen such a resounding win for Mr. Carney during the leadership race is because of the experience he brings forward that could be deployed for in the best interest of all of Canada.
Just to look at the outgoing Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau is only 53 years old. What do you think he's going to do now? Do you think he's going to ride off into the sunset?
First of all, we are grateful to Mr. Trudeau for his remarkable service. He served as the leader of our party for 13 years and prime minister for 10. And he has spent his time as prime minister working day in and day out. He does have three young children. And in my conversations with him privately and what he shared publicly, he's going to be spending more time with his family, with his children, wants to be a dad. And I'm sure he's going to have ample opportunities to advance the causes that that are dear to his heart. And it will help Canada continue to grow as well.
Thank you. Yasir Naqvi is a Liberal Member of Parliament for Ottawa Centre. A major rescue operation is in full swing off the east coast of England after an American and a Portuguese ship collided in the North Sea. The boss of the nearest port said a massive fireball was seen when the Stena Immaculate oil tanker and the Solon container ship hit each other. The collisions led to an environmental crisis, too. The American tanker was carrying aviation fuel. There were explosions on board, and it's now feared that fuel is pouring into the sea from a ruptured tank. I spoke with the BBC's David Wallace Lockhart.
There are a lot of unanswered questions about why exactly this collision happened. We know it was around 10 a.m. this morning. One, the oil tanker Stena Immaculate, which was anchored at the time, and it was a cargo ship called the Solong, which was travelling between Grangemouth in Scotland and Rotterdam in the Netherlands, that seems to have struck this ship. By all the data, it looks like it was going in a fairly straight line, and this Portuguese-flagged ship, the Solong, has hit the American-flagged Stena Immaculate. Downing Street, the UK Prime Minister, saying it's extremely concerning, and marine accident investigation has now been deployed for a preliminary assessment of what happened. But of course, the really damaging aspect of this was about the cargo that these two ships were carrying, and the fallout that appears to have come from that.
I realise that the situation is a bit murky, but can you tell us a little bit about those ships and what we understand that they were carrying?
Yeah, well, what emerged first was the Stena Immaculate was carrying jet fuel owned by the US Department of Defence. And that you'd expect with the pictures we've seen of black smoke billowing out so heavily, you can actually barely see the ships and fire as well on top of the water. You'd imagine may well be because of the fact that it was carrying jet fuel. We should say the local member of parliament has said that 36 mariners across both crews safe and accounted for. One other person has been hospitalised. What has emerged as the day has gone on was that the Solong, the other ship involved here, was carrying 15 containers of sodium cyanide, a highly toxic chemical which can generate toxic gas if heated up. It's unclear at this point if that's actually entered the water and what the effects of that may be.
Just briefly, David, do we know anything about the weather conditions at the time?
The weather conditions were foggy. Visibility does appear to have been a concern, but we've heard from multiple experts on maritime travel throughout the day, and a consistent theme does seem to be that these ships are modern, that they have the sort of technologies that should be able to cope with those sort of conditions, and therefore still big questions which you'll imagine will rumble on for some time now about how exactly two ships like this can come to collide in what is quite a busy shipping route.
David Wallace Lockhart. Meanwhile, the environmental group Greenpeace said it is extremely concerned about multiple toxic hazards from that ship collision. One senior scientist has pointed out that jet fuel that entered the water close to a breeding ground for harbour porpoises is toxic to fish and other sea creatures. Stay with us on NewsHour. Coming up, how the Trump administration's USAID cuts are sending shockwaves globally.
We're nervous. We're scared. We're worried about people dying because of this stoppage, because there's no sort of system to pick it up. So we're looking at just massive, massive stoppages of life-saving activities. It's so destructive and so dangerous on so many levels.
Other stories we're following this hour. Stock markets in the United States have fallen sharply over concerns about the impact of President Trump's trade tariffs and his refusal to rule out a recession. At least 6,000 Syrians are reported to have fled to Lebanon in the last few days to escape violence by the security forces in strongholds of former President Assad. And a former senior officer in the Gambian army who was accused of being a member of a death squad has been found dead in his prison cell. You're listening to NewsHour. Greenland goes to the polls this Tuesday in a pivotal election on the country's future. It's a vote that rarely garners outside attention, but following Donald Trump's interest in acquiring the Arctic territory, the world is watching more closely than ever before. Now, the question of independence and what pace it should take is dominating debate and dividing opinion, as Adrian Murray reports.
In a sports hall in Copenhagen, FC Nanuk are meeting up for their weekly training session. The players share a passion for football and their Greenlandic roots. Though their homeland may be far away, its future is weighing on their minds as their countrymen go to the polls tomorrow. Alec Bertelsen says the spotlight on Greenland has been unreal.
It's been crazy. I think it's been surrealistic and... when we're such a small community, yeah, unbelievable, actually.
Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory within the Kingdom of Denmark, and the question of independence has taken centre stage. The country is 9 times larger than the UK, but with a population of just 57,000. Another 17,000 Greenlanders live in Denmark, but only students can vote. Peter Villa is watching the debate closely.
But I'm trying to keep updated, like the main causes, like independence and the American situation.
Donald Trump's demands that the US acquire Greenland have clearly caused unease.
Can't just occupy us or like whatever. So whenever he says stuff like that, I feel like he's disrespecting us as a country, as a people.
The Arctic island's strategic location and untapped mineral resources have put it firmly in President Trump's sights. And addressing Congress last week, he doubled down.
We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Greenland's leaders have repeatedly rebuffed Trump, and in the snow-covered capital Nuuk, his comments are met with disbelief. Erik Jensen is the Deputy Prime Minister and the chair of party Siumut.
It's a lack of respect for the democratic system in Greenland. When he said the Greenlandic people are incredible, it was followed by laughter from the hall, and the vice president started to laugh.
Javier Arnold is the head of Arctic Social Sciences at the University of Greenland in Nuuk.
It probably has amplified the voices of independence. March 11 will define what are the next steps towards that process of independence.
Moves towards more autonomy have been decades in the making. According to polls, most Greenlanders do back future statehood, but not at any cost.
80% of people are for independence, but at the same time, that independence is not at the expense of losing the standards of living that currently the Greenlandic society has.
The main political parties all support independence, but differ in their roadmap, explains Naya Bianco, a Danish Greenlandic consultant and Arctic policy expert.
4 out of 5 parties are pro-independence, but there's a difference in terms of how to achieve it and with which speed to achieve it.
The Prime Minister's party, IA, and coalition partner Siumut are the two biggest, and both favour a more gradual approach. While the Prime Minister is expected to retain popular support, smaller rivals are thought to gain ground and could shake up alliances, like pro-independence party, Nalarak. Its leader, Pelle Broberg, wants to kickstart divorce proceedings immediately.
Let's hope for a quick process. But as soon as we start that process, we have several other things that will start. One of them will be defense negotiations with the United States about the defense of Greenland when we are independent.
Pro-business party Democratic is also more cautious. Justin Hansen is a candidate.
I feel very strongly for the independence for Greenland, but not right now. We have to have more educated people. Our own local youth, but also economy, have to be much stronger.
In recent weeks, there's been controversy and anger over a now withdrawn documentary made by Danish public broadcaster DR about a valuable creolite mine which Denmark controlled for 130 years. And the betrayal of an Inuit woman by a Danish comedy show sparked racism claims and triggered anti-discrimination protests. Greenland's right to self-determination is enshrined in a 2009 law. But whatever the outcome of this election, experts are clear. Any potential independence referendum is unlikely before Donald Trump's second term is over. Kai Kleist is one of Greenland's former top civil servants.
There is a lot of preparation to make before and negotiations with the Danish government before you can make that a reality.
Adrian Murray reporting.
Hi, it's Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest from Syria, where the Defense Ministry says it's ended military operations in strongholds of former President Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The US government has announced that it's cutting 83% of programs at its main overseas aid agency, USAID. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said the decision had been taken as a result of a six-week review carried out after Donald Trump ordered a freeze on aid spending. Writing on X, Mr. Rubio said the cutback amounted to an overdue and historic reform. He said tens of billions of dollars had been spent that did not serve core U.S. interests. As the world's biggest aid donor, the U.S. has for decades helped to relieve poverty, hunger, and underdevelopment around the world. It was the biggest donor last year to Sudan, where it funded over 1,000 communal kitchens to feed starving people fleeing a brutal civil war. Those kitchens have now shuttered. Andrea Tracy is a former USAID official and also advisor to the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan under the Biden administration. She's now created the Sudan Mutual Aid Coalition, a fund for private donations to reach those kitchens. So what's her reaction to the announcement?
The way that they're going about this is so destructive and so dangerous on so many levels. We're nervous. We're scared. We're worried about people dying because of this stoppage, because there's no sort of system to pick it up. There's not enough money that any other donor has that can pick up what was, generally speaking, from one country to the next, around 40 to 45% of the budgets were being held by USAID. So we're looking at just massive, massive stoppages of life-saving activities. There's a famine happening in parts of northern Darfur and in parts of the Nuba Mountains that is not being addressed. And in Khartoum, there's a growing cholera outbreak in White Nile, spreading to River Nile, southern Kordofan, Khartoum. The situation is incredibly disconcerting.
You were just in Darfur last month, I understand. Can you paint a picture for us? Explain what you saw when you were there and how these potential aid cuts might affect that situation.
I saw desperation. It was bleak. People, they don't have any opportunities for sustaining their own living. There were children with weapons, and I kept thinking to myself, are they being forced into, you know, are they child soldiers? And I genuinely feel like it was people were trying to band together and make it work, but with a complete lack of resources coming in, it's just incredibly difficult for them to do so. It's a desperate situation for them. It's not at all a concert response. In terms of humanitarian assistance, we're talking about life-saving aid, keeping people going, that the U.S. government has been supporting, and just cutting that off, sort of punishing people who are vulnerable and in a terrible position because there's a system that needs to be altered or reformed, is not a commensurate response.
Andrea Tracy, a former USAID official who's now leading a private relief effort in Sudan. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service.
Talks on Ukraine's future and a possible ceasefire with Russia are due to begin tomorrow in Saudi Arabia. A team of Ukrainian negotiators will meet with an American team from the Trump administration, headed by the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. The Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, will also attend. He said that intelligence sharing will be discussed, and the U.S. hopes to sign a deal on critical minerals. Washington expects substantial progress to be made during the talks with Ukraine this week. That's according to a senior U.S. diplomat. The Russian side is not taking part, but how might the Russian leader Vladimir Putin be viewing all of this? Earlier, I spoke to the former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov. He was the Prime Minister under Vladimir Putin for 4 years until 2004. He's now a prominent critic of Mr. Putin and lives in exile. I asked him what will be going through Mr. Putin's head as Ukrainian and U.S. officials meet in Saudi Arabia.
First, that is important, the meeting between American government delegation and the Ukrainian officials, so that with the purpose to reestablish good relations between Ukraine and the United States. I think that's crucial, and that will be the most expected and desirable result of this. And I think just there will not be any, I would say, great progress so that Mr. Putin could be worried about, because just recent statements of President Trump was in favor of Mr. Putin.
And do you think that Mr. Putin is trying to strengthen his hand even more with this advance in the Kursk region by Russian forces, by pushing forward with that advance and trying to remove Ukrainians from Russian soil? Is this an attempt to further diminish Ukraine's power?
I think that is the goal of Mr. Putin since September last year. In fact, till now, he couldn't just press Ukrainian army just and get them out of the territory of Kursk Oblast. And that's why just, of course, and during this preparation for talks, of course, he wants also just to demonstrate to the West, and the most important thing, to Russian people, that he got out just Ukrainians from territory of Kursk region. And that is appeared to be possible because just decision of U.S. administration of President Trump to suspend just sharing of intelligence information was crucial for Ukrainian army. And right now, Putin's army appeared to be just getting an advantage. And that's why just they use this advantage on the Kursk region.
Mr. Putin does face some challenges, though, doesn't he? For example, the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is about to host another round of talks featuring countries willing to support a peacekeeping mission in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has already said that Western boots on the ground would be simply unacceptable. Do you think, though, that he would be willing to budge on this to some degree? What would he be willing to accept when it comes to some sort of peacekeeping mission?
I think negotiations would come to this stage. I don't believe any results would be achieved with Mr. Putin for 3, 4, 5 months. Nothing to do with this. Mr. Putin is not willing to negotiate. He is willing just to reestablish relations with the United States. He is not going to sit down with President Zelensky and to negotiate just ceasefire agreement and just potential peacekeepers just on the ground. He conducting just war of attrition, and believes that Ukraine losing the position step by step, etc. And Mr. Trump is playing on his part.
Take me through the next 3 or 4 months, though, from Vladimir Putin's perspective. From what you're saying, he simply will push on with the war and try to achieve his goals when it comes to Ukraine, all while building up relations with the Trump administration. Do you believe he can continue to do this both at the same time?
First of all, he did nothing till now. There was only just some kind of statements, but no negotiations. There was one meeting just and was devoted to reestablishing diplomatic ties between Russia and the United States. Nothing to do about Ukraine. He believes he has a strong position, and he continues to conduct this war. And there is no need for him just to negotiate anything. He already got a lot. He already got promise that Ukraine never be part of NATO. He already got a promise that Ukraine never reestablished the borders as it was 1991. And now just he demands more. just lifting sanctions. That's what he wants now. And Mr. Trump already said something about that. He considered with his administration softening just sanctions, which is absolutely crucial for the whole situation. The revenue which comes to Russia out of sale of oil international market, that is just funding the war. That is strange that the President of the United States just already not a neutral player. He's taken the position of aggressor. I don't want to believe that it will be reality. But two decisions of to suspend military support of Ukraine and decision to suspend just sharing of intelligence information just demonstrates he already moving on this direction.
You're describing a man who sounds as if he's at the height of his power. But in the past, you've always been very optimistic that eventually Putin would fall from power and Russia would return to democracy. Given what you've just described, this new dynamic between Washington and Moscow, do you still think this is possible?
I continue to believe that changes in Russia is possible. But the key, the trigger for this, that's victory of Ukraine. Mr. Putin should be seen by public, by Russian public, as weak, as defeated. In this case, just the whole reconsideration of attitude to him and to the war will start in the Russian public. First of all, in the so-called Putin elites. They will not be seeing him as a moderator or the leader, and they will start just behave differently. But again, I would like to emphasize the trigger for this, the beginning of this, the key, that is Putin's defeat on the battlefield. Ukraine should win this war and to defend its sovereignty and territorial integrity.
The former Russian Prime Minister and current Putin critic, Mikhail Kazyanov. Let's turn to events inside Syria now and the news that at least 6,000 Syrians have crossed into Lebanon following mass violence against the Alawite community over the weekend. The Syrian interim president and former rebel leader Ahmed al-Shara has announced an investigation into the reported deaths of over 1,000 people, most of them Alawites. That's the community where the deposed president Bashar al-Assad came from. Here on NewsHour, we've heard over the past few days from people who've witnessed some of those attacks. Itta Helland Hansen is a project coordinator for the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. She was in the town of Jisr al-Shagur and sent us a voice note on the situation there.
Yesterday, I was in the MSF-supported hospital Jisr al-Shagur. They've been working around the clock for the last few days, receiving 107 patients due to bullet wounds, shrapnel, and other violent trauma, including 13 who did not survive. Personally, I saw patients who were recovering from surgeries due to injuries in their abdomen and chest, arms and legs, and some were hit several places.
Ziad Haider is a Syrian journalist currently in Barcelona whose family are from the Syrian coast. I spoke to him a short time ago and I asked him about the total number of people killed that he's aware of.
The Syrian Human Rights Observatory said that the documented number of civilians being killed was 1,018.
Ziad, were these killings state-sanctioned, in your opinion?
The videos, all the videos that we've seen, are videos of soldiers or military personnel that are affiliated or related or have a very good relation and cooperation with the government. Most of the videos have the same rhetoric, have the same way of killing, have the same looks and the same uniforms. They're not government officials, they're not government personnel for sure, from what we've seen, but they are from the factions that the government asked for their cooperation and help in the battle against the, you know, the regime remnants. So in the end, there is a big responsibility here. And although we cannot define us, we cannot define by name who are the killers, but I think the government knows very well who are the factions that were or most responsible for the killings or for the massacres.
16 members of the government security forces were killed in an ambush last week. Do you believe that Iran and Hezbollah played a role in inciting former regime elements to and attack the new security services?
This is something that, you know, goes back to the same, you know, rhetoric, the same type of conclusions the former regime used to use when fighting, you know, the revolution. The idea of the foreign player trying to meddle with the internal affairs is something that Syria has to be used to. But at the same level, this is not something that can be proved yet. And you need to also mind the idea that this has happened in an area which has no logistic or geographical connection with neither Iran or Lebanon. The nearest border is actually the Turkish border to this area. And so the idea of, you know, having some logistic, you know, backup or any sort of backup is just not real. The other thing is that it was a suicidal attack. There is no way that these militants, whoever they are, how many they are, we don't know. It was suicidal. There is no way they can win a war. There is no way they can win a back battle. And the other important thing is that the actual community in these areas, they don't want to fight. Mm. They are fed up with fighting. They've been fighting for 14 years. Most of their youngest have been killed.
What does the violence of the last few days mean for the position of Alawites in this new Syria?
It's very scary, of course. The idea of this happening was always the fear when Assad was ruling, and this was the actual excuse that he always used, you know, for being in power, that I am protecting you. And now with this happening, it proves that, well, there has been threats and the threats are real. The problem is you cannot resolve this by another revenge. There is no way to resolve this but the way of actually cooperating with the government from one side and with other parts of the society from the other side. There is no way to protect any part of society in Syria. It can only be protected by the other side of society. There is no other way. And so the problem is, although the government has been responsible for what happened, directly or indirectly, but it is the only solution for resolving this matter and to preventing it from happening again.
Ziad Haider, a Syrian journalist speaking to us from Barcelona. For more on this story, go to the BBC News website where you can find interviews with Alawites who've fled to Lebanon. And more on the news that the Syrian Defense Ministry says it's completed a military operation in the country's coastal region following days of violence there. That's all from us for this edition of NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton. For me and the rest of the team here, thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest from Syria, where the Defense Ministry says it's ended military operations in strongholds of former President Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.